House Republicans are meeting today to come up with a strategy to delay or defeat the Affordable Care Act, the national health care reform law commonly known as Obamacare. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, September 17th. Meanwhile, a new USA Today Pew Research Center poll out yesterday finds more people are against Obamacare than for it and think the country will be worse off, not better off, because of it. What do you think of the Affordable Care Act and the efforts by House Republicans to try to repeal it or possibly defund it? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will talk with a critic of Obamacare this hour about the problems he sees with the law and what he hopes congressional Republicans will do about it. And he'll answer your questions and respond to your views as well at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And I might add, for those keeping score, that the last time we talked about the Affordable Care Act and the implementation of it, we talked with a proponent of Obamacare. For another perspective now, we are joined by Ovik Roy, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, columnist for the National Review Online, and a contributor to Forbes.com. He is also the editor and principal author of The Apothecary, a Forbes blog on healthcare policy and entitlement reform. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks very much for being with us. So House Republicans are expected to be putting their heads together today to come up with some sort of opposition strategy to Obamacare. How would you advise them to proceed?
Well, I think that the faction of conservatives in Congress who believe that the president will be eager to defund his signature health law are wrong. I think that a more constructive approach is to encourage the president to perhaps delay the implementation of the law for a year, because there are a number of problems with the exchanges. A lot of them aren't going to be ready on time. A lot of the income verification and privacy safeguards aren't ready yet. Those are the kinds of things I think that Republicans should focus on, is making sure that the exchanges work well, as opposed to trying to convince the president to neuter the law that he fought so hard to pass.
Why do you think those Republicans who have pushed for a government shutdown as a way of defunding Obamacare are wrong?
Well, I think that from their point of view, first of all, let's understand their own logic. So the logic of the people who support that approach of risking a government shutdown to defund the law do so because they're worried that once the law goes into effect, the history of government programs is once they're online and the money is out the door, they're very hard to roll back. So that's the concern that they have. And I don't disagree with that point of view in the sense of the way the history of government programs works. I just feel like the opportunity to make that case was in 2012. Republicans lost that election, and so now Republicans have to take a more realistic view. The law is going to go into effect, and it's important to improve it and or reform it rather than attempt to repeal it.
What are the problems with the exchanges?
Well, there's a number of problems with the exchanges. I think, you know, in terms of the things I just mentioned, the implementation of the exchanges, there's been a lot of delays. There's a lot of concern that the exchanges won't be ready on time. That again, privacy is not going to be safeguarded. So there are a lot of federal regulations, federal laws actually, around the privacy of your financial and medical records, or federal records in general, your individual records that are owned by or processed or obtained by the government. And these fairly technical things about how the computer systems are set up to ensure that hackers can't get in and access your records, those safeguards haven't yet been set up. That's one example. But really, from a longer term standpoint, these are more short term issues. I think the longer term issue is that for many people on the exchanges, the cost of insurance will go up. And the law is, of course, called the Affordable Care Act officially, right? And so the promise of the law is that it would make health care more affordable. And yes, there will be some people due to subsidies who will fare better under the law. But a large number of people will actually have more costly health insurance due to the Affordable Care Act. And I think that's, from a policy standpoint, the biggest problem with the law.
Yeah. You support a plan that's being floated by House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. What does he want to do, and why is that the way to go?
Well, Representative Cantor has proposed is that the House pass a continuing resolution. So just to explain that to your listeners, what happens is the government is set to run out of money at the end of this month unless the Congress passes what's called a continuing resolution, which funds the government's operations. And what the kind of activists have said is that, well, let's use that point as leverage to defund Obamacare. And what Leader Cantor is saying is, well, let's pass a continuing resolution that funds the government, including the Affordable Care Act. Let's have a separate resolution that defunds the Affordable Care Act, that's sort of physically separate from that main continuing resolution. Send them both to the Senate, and that way the Senate will have to vote on the defund resolution, either up or down. And if they say yes, then Republicans win. If they say no, they don't want to defund Obamacare, then the continuing resolution they can still pass, and then the government continues to work, and the crisis is averted. So it's a way to allow people to express their views on whether or not they want to defund the Affordable Care Act without precipitating a crisis of shutting down the government. That's the appeal.
So defunding it, though, would just delay it, or would it defeat it?
Well, the proposal from Leader Cantor would be to defund the Affordable Care Act, I believe, completely. So, well, in theory, it's just for 1 year anyway, because the continuing resolution really only works for 1 year. So you'd have to pass another continuing resolution in 2014 at around the same time. So whatever the continuing resolution says, you know, the effect of it is to delay the implementation of the law for 1 year, because that's how long the continuing resolution would last.
Yeah. The Senate's not likely to defund it.
Well, the Senate, of course, is controlled by Democrats, and you would think that as a result, the Democrats would vote to fund the law. I suppose one could make the case that there might be Democrats who hail from Republican-leaning states who could be persuaded to go along with defund resolution, but that would be up to the conservative grassroots activists to persuade them to do so.
Meanwhile, there's this new poll out from Pew and USA Today showing that 53% of those surveyed disapprove of Obamacare, 42% approve of it. That's reportedly as negative as it's been. Why do you suppose Americans are feeling this way?
Well, you know, Paul Starr, who's a sociologist at Princeton and has written the definitive book on the history of American medicine, who is a great supporter of the Affordable Care Act, describes this problem as a policy trap, which is to say, we already heavily subsidize health care for so many people, and the healthcare system today works well, it's perceived to work well for so many people, that anytime you make substantial changes to the healthcare system that are going to benefit a certain population at the expense of a broader population, it's going to be unpopular. So the way the Affordable Care Act works is that it subsidizes the cost of coverage for people who are uninsured today. But a number of the things that the law does will drive up the cost of insurance for people who are already covered. So I think, you know, the president sold this law as it's not going to affect the people who are already covered, it's just going to benefit the people who aren't covered. And I think the perception that a lot of people have, and it's not an inaccurate one, is that the people who actually already are covered are going to face higher costs as a result of this law. Whatever you think of the social goal or the public goal of and the public interest of expanding coverage, those people who have coverage already are facing higher costs. And that's why they see it as, well, this isn't helping me, so that's why I'm unhappy. I think that's a big part of the problem.
So what evidence do we have that the cost of health care is going to go up?
Well, we have the data. So since 2010, the cost of health insurance across the country has gone up. But some of that is due to the standard health care inflation that goes on every year, where the cost of health care exceeds the growth in the cost of health care exceeds that of the consumer price index, the standard measure of inflation. But a big chunk of it also is the regulations and taxes and mandates that the law imposes on the delivery of insurance. So, for example, the Affordable Care Act imposes a sales tax, a premium tax or health insurance tax on all private insurers. And effectively what that does is if you impose a tax on insurance companies, they're forced, because they have such low profit margins or operating margins, to then pass that on to consumers in the form of higher costs. Another way in which this works is the law has a lot of what it calls essential health benefits that it requires insurers to cover. And sometimes insurers already cover many of those benefits. But by adding on requirements, that also drives up the cost of insurance. So, for example, imagine if the federal government said that every car sold in America had to have a hybrid engine. Now, we might think that's great because hybrid engines are more fuel efficient than conventional engines, combustion engines. But hybrid engines are more expensive, and if you forced every car on the street to have a hybrid engine, the cost of buying a car would go up quite a bit. Similarly, if you force insurers to cover all these services and offer all these benefits and pay all these taxes that they don't today, those eventually get passed down in the form of higher premiums.
We are talking with Ovik Roy, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He is also the principal author at The Apothecary, a Forbes blog on healthcare policy and entitlement reform. We are talking with him about Obamacare, about the Affordable Care Act, talking about some of the latest developments, problems that he sees with it, tactics that he thinks might work for its opponents, and we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your views. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Will Obamacare be good for you or good for the country or not? Let us know what you think. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Two weeks before the opening of the federal health insurance exchanges, a USA Today Pew Research poll has found more Americans are strongly against Obamacare than strongly for it. Meanwhile, House Republicans are gearing up today to talk about strategies for defeating or defunding the law. We are talking with a conservative analyst about the latest developments in Obamacare, and we are welcoming your questions and your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you want Republicans to somehow delay or defund the Affordable Care Act, to delay this or defeat it in some way or not? Let us know what you think. Well, we have so many calls. Let's go to the phones. Our guest is Ovik Roy, again, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a columnist for National Review Online and Forbes.com. Ivy in Evansville is with us. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. I am for the Affordable Health Care Act. And one of the reasons is it comes through an example with my brother, who had a business, who had insurance. Insurance company dropped him when he was middle-aged, no explanation. My brother became ill. Unbeknownst to him, he had sleep apnea, which is now known to lead to enlarged hearts. And he lost his business, and when he went to the hospital, he almost died. And guess who paid for it? The rest of us. And, you know, he wanted to work. Now he's on disability. He is not contributing to the tax base, feels miserable that he can't work a full day. If he had had that test, he might have been able to prevent this illness. No one who wants to start a business, who is married to someone who has insurance or has their own insurance, will find it easy to take that risk to go out and be an entrepreneur. I find it hypocritical that the people in Congress who say you don't want insurance have insurance and will always have insurance. And it doesn't surprise me that people are opposed to it because they have done their utmost to confuse the issue and not to educate people.
What's your reaction to that, Ulrich Roy?
Yeah, I think the caller brings up some very important points. So one of the biggest inefficiencies in the American healthcare system, and has been so for 80 years or 70 years, has been the fact that people don't buy insurance for themselves. They usually are dependent on their employers or the government to offer that insurance for them. And that's most economists, left or right, agree that that's one of the biggest problems in our system, is that we have this massive tax subsidy for people who get insurance through their work, and so people don't have the incentive to take that insurance with them from job to job, because if it's attached to your work, it's harder to do. And so I think one of the things that the Affordable Care Act does that I actually like, as a critic of the law overall, I think that it does move us more towards a system in which, at least for a certain population, people who will be able to buy insurance on their own and keep that insurance as they go from job to job. I think that is the way that we should go, and the Affordable Care Act does a lot to expand the market for individually purchased health insurance. And that's something that conservative or free market reforms also do. And I do think that the caller is right to criticize Republicans for not having pushed for those kinds of reforms when they were in charge.
A listener on Facebook says, the right question to ask is whether Obamacare is better than what existed before. I'm not a fan of Obamacare, but no way do I want to go back to what we had before, where insurance companies could do whatever they wanted. Also, insurance companies are not against Obamacare because the government has mandated that everyone get insurance. Who doesn't want free and forcibly obtained patients?
Right. The insurance companies are doing very well under this system. That's why if you look at the stock prices of insurance companies, they've gone way up. The insurance companies are going to do very well under the Affordable Care Act. That is true. In terms of whether the law is better or worse than the status quo, I just mentioned an area where I believe that it does make an improvement in that it encourages and expands the market for individually purchased health insurance. I think that's very important. However, the biggest problem with our healthcare system, by far, is that it's too expensive. That's why we have so many uninsured people in America, is because people can't afford to buy this very costly insurance product. And the reason health insurance is so expensive, the fundamental reasons, are not addressed by this law. It makes health insurance actually more expensive, not less. And that has two effects. The first effect is that middle-class people who struggle to afford health insurance, who don't benefit from the subsidies that the law offers to very low-income people, those people are going to struggle even more. And in addition, the law, by driving up the cost of insurance, means that the federal government will spend a lot more subsidizing health insurance, and that means that the fiscal situation of the country will be less stable than it otherwise could have been. So, as I said, I think it would be a good thing to improve and reform the market, and the caller is right to say that the status quo was terrible. I don't think anybody endorses the status quo, at least I certainly don't, and I don't know anyone who supports sort of free market healthcare reform who thinks the status quo is good at all. And to the point I made before, it is Republicans' fault that they haven't, that this has not been a policy priority for Republicans when they've been in power.
So pass some laws that will reduce the cost of health care. What about that?
Yeah, that would be great. And I think you start by encouraging more people to shop for coverage on their own instead of getting it from their employer. So you equalize the tax treatment of employer-sponsored and individually purchased health insurance. That's step number one. And step number two is, you know, to say that insurance companies could do whatever they want before isn't true. Insurers were heavily regulated at the state level. Of course, the level of regulation might vary from state to state, but generally speaking, insurers were fairly heavily regulated at the state level. There aren't Insurers can't just do whatever they want. Now what's happened is the federal government has imposed a uniform, one-size-fits-all standard on states. But that is going to drive up costs. So, for example, in Wisconsin, Jonathan Gruber, one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, an MIT economist, estimated in a report to the state government that premiums for individually purchased insurance in Wisconsin will go up 30%. The Society of Actuaries, a nonpartisan group that studies the science of insurance, they've estimated that Wisconsin individually purchased insurance will see an 81% increase, or an 80% increase, excuse me, in the cost of individually purchased insurance. So that's, we can do a lot to make insurance more affordable, but we have to recognize that when you require insurers to do a lot of stuff, that stuff costs money. And so there's no such thing as a free lunch. Every time you force an insurer to do something that may seem like a benefit to the consumer, quote-unquote, what that ends up doing is raising the cost for everybody else.
We are talking with Ovik Roy, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, columnist for the National Review Online, and contributor to Forbes.com. He is generally a critic of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, and we are getting his take on its implementation. Today, House Republicans are going to be meeting to talk about strategies for trying to defeat the law. There's been some talk about linking it to a government shutdown to defund it. Our guest says that's not the right approach, but delaying it is a good idea. We're welcoming your thoughts and your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. So what do you think of the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, and the efforts by House Republicans to try to repeal it or defund it or defeat it in some way? Will you be better or worse off because of Obamacare? What about the country? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio at 7:37 on this Tuesday, September 17th. House Republicans are meeting today to come up with some sort of strategy to defeat Obamacare. Meanwhile, a new USA Today Pew Research Center poll just out finds more people are against Obamacare than for it and think the country will be worse off, not better off, because of it. We are getting a conservative take on Obamacare this time. The last time we talked about the issue, we talked to somebody who was a proponent of the law. Today we are talking with Ovik Roy, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, columnist for the National Review Online and Forbes.com. He's the editor and principal author at The Apothecary, a Forbes blog on healthcare policy and entitlement reform. We have Aaron on Facebook who writes, of course they, poll respondents, disapprove of Obamacare. When you ask them, though, all the individual parts that make up Obamacare, a majority support all of them. Ovik Roy, isn't that true when you ask the different components? We like it, but just overall we don't think it's a good idea?
Well, yes and no. So the problem with asking about individual components of the law is it divorces the benefits of the law from its costs. So if you require all car companies to offer only cars with hybrid cars, it may sound great in a poll. But when you ask people, well, are you willing to spend an extra $15,000 on the car that has the hybrid engine, most would say no. And similarly with the Affordable Care Act, it all sounds great when you only talk about the benefits and not the costs. But when an accurate poll that describes both the benefits and the costs, the law becomes less popular, not more.
Right, but we as a whole like the fact that our kids until they're 26 are covered and that insurance companies can't discriminate because of pre-existing conditions, but we don't want to pay for it.
Yeah, look, the under 26 provision, if that was the entirety of the Affordable Care Act, the law would be extremely popular. So that's a relatively trivial provision within the overall scope of this very, very large and comprehensive change to our healthcare system. But to the point about the pre-existing condition, that's more gets to the heart of it. It sounds great to say we're going to protect everyone even if they have pre-existing conditions, but when people wake up and they see that their premiums are going to go up 30 to 80% as a result, they're less happy. And so, again, that's the appropriate way to think about it, is that we as a society have to decide, are we willing to pay more for health insurance in order to provide these benefits to people, for example, who can't find insurance because of pre-existing conditions? And that's, I think, a more honest and economically accurate way to frame the debate. And I think an important thing to understand, too, is that the percentage of Americans who can't get health insurance today because of a pre-existing condition is actually extremely small, vanishingly small. The real problem is that if you've gone uninsured and you have a pre-existing condition, you might be able to get insurance, but that insurance will be very expensive. And so I think it's important to understand that the real problem typically for people is not the availability of insurance, it's the availability of affordable insurance.
Let's go to John in Partyville. Hello, John.
Yes, good morning, Joy.
Good morning. What's your question or view?
Well, yeah, I was going to ask the gentleman there if all lawmaking powers have to start with the Senate and House of Representatives and then passed on to the president to sign into law. How did this law get passed? And two, in Article 1, Section 8, paragraph 17, it says to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 square miles. So it doesn't look like that Obamacare pertains to us out here. It's only the 10 square miles of Washington, D.C. and any federal employees.
Yeah, well, it's been to courts, and aren't the courts saying it's constitutional, Overcroy?
Yeah, so what the gentleman brings up, his first point is a point that I have heard other conservatives raise, which is that all legislation originates in the House, and didn't this originate from a Senate bill? Because if you remember what the history of how the law was passed, it was actually a Senate bill that the House then deemed and passed, and then they modified it a little bit at the end. And so the argument is, well, it originated in the Senate, and therefore it's unconstitutional. And I'd say a couple of things. One, typically what the Senate does is they take a shell of a House bill and make that into the Senate bill to avoid that technicality, number one. Number two, the Supreme Court and federal courts in general have not aggressively enforced that provision of the Constitution. So there's a pretty heavy list now of precedents of laws that have been passed without technically being originated in the House or using the shell procedure that the Supreme Court and the federal courts have not bothered to do anything with. So I think that if you were to sue on that basis, you'd probably get nowhere, fortunately or unfortunately. And on the second point about D.C., well, Congress has been passing laws that affect the broader country for a long time, and to his point, Article 1, Section 8 does give Congress a fair number of discrete powers to do so. That definition of those powers has expanded over time in terms of the court's interpretations, but there you have it.
Joe Indepeer is with us now. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I'm about to retire, but because of some pre-existing conditions, be very difficult or expensive for me to get insurance, but I can now with the Affordable Care Act. But if you guys are against it, what alternatives are you offering to cover stuff like the pre-existing conditions, the other problems that have been mentioned earlier in the program?
Well, there are a number of different alternative approaches to addressing the problem of pre-existing conditions. And I would get back to what I said at the beginning, which is that the fundamental problem, the reason why we have this pre-existing condition problem in the first place, is because people don't own their own insurance policies. So when you have a system where you're dependent on your employer or the government to provide your insurance for you, if you change jobs, or you lose your eligibility for the government program, you're out on the street in terms of your insurance coverage. And that's a problem. The system we should have is a system where you own your insurance policy. Just like when you buy car insurance or homeowners insurance, you don't get that from your employer or the government. You get that for yourself. And similarly, that's exactly how health insurance would be. And if it worked that way, then there would be no issue of retiring or changing jobs or what have you. You'd still keep your insurance. That's the vision of where we should go. And then there's a lot of technical things about how you would transition the system we have today to that system. And I could recommend to you an article that was published 2 years ago in National Affairs called "How to Deal with Pre-Existing Conditions" by Jim Capretta. And I believe it was Tom Miller of the American Enterprise Institute. There's a lot of things you have to do to get from here to there. But that's the vision. The vision is a system where you own your own insurance plan. So whether you're employed or unemployed or self-employed, it doesn't matter.
So how does that reduce the cost of it?
Because if you're shopping for your own coverage, when you control your own health dollars, you're going to be much more frugal in how you spend that money. So the way things work today is that the vast majority of people who have coverage, about 90% of the people who have insurance coverage today, don't shop for it themselves. You get it from your employer, you get it from the government. And that makes you insensitive to the cost. The way I try to explain it to people is imagine an open bar at a wedding where, you know, if it's a cash bar, maybe you're going to get the house wine or the beer or what have you. But if it's an open bar, maybe you're going to be price insensitive and you'll get the top shelf liquor. And the same thing is true with any sort of economic marketplace. If you are insulated from the cost because you're not shopping for it yourself, then you're basically, the way it works today for most people is you have a job. That job offers you health insurance, and you just sort of expect when you're sick or when you go to the doctor, it's going to be covered by your insurance plan. That you don't realize how much you're paying for that insurance plan in whole. You might pay for part of it in terms of premiums or copays or whatever, but usually your employer is paying for part of that and taking it out of your paycheck. So people don't really have that sense, because it doesn't say on your paycheck, okay, here's how much you made in salary and wages, and here's how much we took out of your paycheck for your health insurance plan. And that psychological disincentive is what prevents a lot of people from getting the plans that are really suited to them. So if people shop for their own coverage, they'd have much more cost-efficient coverage. They'd look at their bill and say, hey, why was I charged so much for this when I didn't really need that service or that benefit? And all of a sudden you have a real market, just like with any other product or service, where, again, like auto insurance. You know, a lot of people have auto insurance, but people shop for it themselves, and it works reasonably well.
Well, why wouldn't employers who grouse about this just shop for that cheapo insurance?
They do to a degree, but the incentive of an employer versus the incentive of the employee are quite different. So the thing about the current system, the employer-sponsored system, is that actually employers like it. The reason why is because the fact that employees are afraid to leave their jobs because of their health coverage is good for the employer, right? It makes it easier to retain your employees. You don't have to work as hard to retain your employees with, say, higher wages or other benefits or just treating them better. And so employers, they have an incentive to say, you know what, we're gonna offer our employees as a group kind of one-size-fits-all coverage, but maybe you and your family have particular needs. Maybe you have a kid with a particular a disorder, and you need an insurance plan that will particularly be focused on that. Or maybe you're the kind of person who goes to the gym all the time, and you want a plan that rewards you for being as healthy as possible. Those kinds of individualistic approaches can't be done in a one-size-fits-all plan. The employer selects the plan that's the best deal for the employer. That's not necessarily the best deal for every individual employee.
Well, Bonnie emails, Bonnie from Mount Horeb, why is it that we can purchase a car, food, or any other items, but dealing with services from healthcare providers, we never know the cost until we get the bill? Will this ever change?
That is a great question. That's exactly what I'm talking about. So that is precisely the problem, is that there is no price transparency. And the reason there's no price transparency, the reason you don't know how much it costs when you go to the doctor, you go to the hospital, is because it's all paid by someone else. So if you're a hospital or a doctor, your customer is not the patient. Your customer is the insurance company or the government, the people who actually pay your bills. And so they see the cost, they see the prices, but the patient doesn't. And that's the reason why costs are so high, is because patients aren't the only, the best steward of your own money is you. It's not someone else. And so if in situations, to take this example, so if you look at LASIK surgery, for those who don't know, is that surgery where instead of wearing, having eyeglasses or contact lenses, they do laser surgery on your eyes and, mm-hmm. and fix your eyes. I got it 5 or 6 years ago and it's worked great for me. But LASIK surgery isn't covered by insurance companies. Why? Because the insurance company figures it's a lot cheaper to give you a pair of eyeglasses than to give you a very expensive LASIK surgery. So what happens? LASIK surgery is advertised. The people compete on price. They say, you know what, I've got the latest, best laser, and I'm going to charge you less than the doctor, the surgeon across the street. And so there's competition. Prices have gone down. The quality has gone up. The technology has gotten better. All the things that we would expect with computers or cars or anything else. And that's a contrast to what we see with the rest of the healthcare system. And the difference is that with LASIK, you're paying for it yourself directly, and with most other healthcare services, they're paid by somebody else. So the more things that we can move into that paradigm where the patient is actually in charge of the dollars, that's a better system. And that doesn't mean leaving people on their own. You can subsidize that. You can use taxpayer funds to give people health savings accounts, for example, that are subsidized by the government to help pay for those costs. But if you do that and you make people give people the opportunity to control their own health dollars, you're going to have a much more efficient system.
We are getting a conservative take on Obamacare and welcoming your questions, your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Ovik Roy, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, about the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Our next caller is Jay in Madison. Hello, Jay.
Good morning. Great show. I'm a little concerned about the future. I agree with all your observations. However, even if a little bit of this happens to get through, is that enough, do you think, to stop the steady creep towards nationalized medicine, nationalized health care? Because that really is one of the cornerstones of socialism. And I'm afraid that if even, you know, it's like being a little bit pregnant. It's just going to march on until it consumes us, because the private industry is going to eventually disappear. And I believe this is by design.
Do you?
Yeah, I hear that concern from a lot of people that the reason to be concerned and to oppose Obamacare is because it's a Trojan horse for single payer healthcare, which is though there's an energetic group of people who support single payer, it's broadly unpopular in the country. And I'm actually not concerned about that. I think that I do talk to people on the left who say, you know what, we're not passionate about Obamacare because it relies on private insurers to expand coverage, and that's something that we as single payer advocates don't really like. My view is this, that as I mentioned earlier in the program, precisely because what the law does is it encourages people to buy insurance on their own, private insurance. That I've argued that the law has flaws, particularly because it drives up the cost of insurance. I think that once you give people insurance through that mechanism, that is to say, they've shopped for it themselves on a private, on a state-sponsored exchange in which it's a private insurance product that they're buying, I think it's a lot harder to persuade people to give that up for a government alternative. Some people might want a government alternative, but most people who have private coverage tend to be happy with it and tend not to want private coverage. If you look at the Medicare program, for example, so Medicare now has an option where you can have your Medicare benefit administered by a private insurer. It's called Medicare Advantage. And that program is increasingly popular. Every year, the number of people who enroll in Medicare Advantage goes up. So today, over, I think, a third of people, a third of retirees are now on Medicare Advantage. And 10 years ago, it was only 15%. So the percentage of retirees on Medicare Advantage, the privately administered program, has gone up substantially. And a big part of the reason why is because the private insurers have certain cost efficiencies, and this is a whole complicated topic, but they have certain efficiencies which have allowed them to provide services that the standard government-run Medicare program did not. And so more and more, particularly younger retirees who've had private insurance their whole lives and have been happy with it, have sought that out. So I think that as much as there are a lot of things about the Affordable Care Act I think are unwise or bad policy, I think overall I don't think it moves us to a single payer system. In fact, when you talk to the people who helped design the program, they would agree with that. They think that they're sad about it. They think, well, you know, I like single payer, and I don't think this moves us in that direction, unfortunately, and I agree with them.
Ron in Lake Geneva is with us. Hello, Ron.
Hello. Good morning. I'm for Obamacare. I lost my job. I'm 56 years old. Actually, I'm for single payer. In my old job, I met people from all over the world. I would ask them, how do you like your health care in Canada? And they say, we love it. I would rather pay 7% on my check, even though I just lost my job, to single payer than 20% of my check to the insurance companies when it comes down to the premiums.
Thank you, Ron. Because we're so short on time, I also want to get in Frankie in Fort Atkinson. Hello, Frankie.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. I'm for Obamacare also, and I agree with the gentleman who just called before. But also one of the reasons I'm for Obamacare is because it gives access to health insurance to people who haven't traditionally had it. There are also some, it will also allow them to get health care at an earlier stage instead of waiting for them to get so sick that they end up in the hospital emergency rooms or need more intensive, more expensive care.
Yeah, we get it. And because, again, short on time, I apologize. Won't that help reduce the health care costs, Ulvik Roy?
Yeah, so if we look at the situation in Massachusetts, where obviously a similar reform was passed, that's not what happened. So it turns out that the percentage of national health expenditures that comes from uncompensated care in the emergency room is actually very small. It's about 1.5%, 1.7%, of which only a third really applies to the population that's affected by the Affordable Care Act. So it's under 1% of national health expenditures are driven by this uncompensated care problem in the emergency room. And remember, it's just the emergency room, right? So what the Affordable Care Act does, it has an individual mandate that requires you to buy fairly comprehensive insurance that covers a lot more things than emergency room care in order to address a problem of emergency room uncompensated care. So what ends up happening is in Massachusetts, yes, they saved some money on uncompensated care in the emergency room, about $200 million a year, but they spent an additional $800 million on all the subsidies and increased costs from the program. So it didn't actually bring costs down. It drove costs up, and I'm concerned that that's what we're going to see across the country.
In less than a minute, what's going to happen?
Well, I think the biggest question in the next year, and the thing that a lot of people are going to be focused on, is whether the young and healthy people are going to sign up for this product, this insurance product designed by the Affordable Care Act. Because the way the program works is those young and healthy people are going to have to spend a lot more for their health insurance than they do today. And so the question is, will the Affordable Care Act make health insurance more affordable for them? Will it make it easier for those people to buy insurance and obtain insurance? If it doesn't, then the Affordable Care Act will cost a lot more and be a lot less affordable than optimists would hope.
Thank you so much for being with us. Ulvik Roy is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Thanks to Bill Martins, to Christy Taylor, and to Robin Cherry for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.